All right, so today I am continuing with answering questions that were submitted a couple weeks ago when I did a Dharma Q&A, and people online submitted questions in the chat, and others submitted them on pieces of paper. So I have three questions on my list today. But maybe we won't even get through all of it. Like, I thought we were going to get through all these questions last week, but we ended up just getting into a nice discussion. So open to that happening. So one of the questions was, what happens to Sangha members who don't become members or Buddhists? And so I'll explain a little bit about what each of those steps is first. Our activities, whether that is a Tuesday practice or a Sunday practice, the weekday morning sitting, our retreats are, generally speaking, I really can't think of anything unless it's like some kind of very special event. Almost everything is open to anyone who wants to participate. But if you participate for a while and you get a lot out of it and want to help support the organization, then you can become a member. And at this point, that's all that really means is that you give us your contact information and kind of say, yes, I want to be a member, I want to be included, and you make some kind of financial pledge. And we have members who give anywhere between, I mean, honestly, we have some Sangha members who really can't afford to give anything. Or just every once in a while, they give $5 or $10 or something, all the way to be some people who give $250 a month. The average is around 50. So, like, basically, it's some kind of financial pledge. And to some extent, the important thing from our perspective is just when, the board is sitting and thinking about the Zen Center and making plans and whatever, it's like, well, how many members do we have? That's a measure of how many people are belong and care and want to support. But there are, for those members, and what we look at for continued membership is, are you continuing to pledge financially or are you continuing to participate? If you don't participate or pledge, then we're like, well, I don't know. I mean, our member steward reaches out to you, but it, essentially then like that, we consider you not a member anymore if you're not connected with us in some way, either financially or through participation. But then we do have a handful of members who only donate. They just like what we do, and they don't tend to participate at all, but they just support us. And other than that, it's not, as so as long as the participation and or the financial support continues, you're a member. And you're added to our Sangha email list, and you can vote for our people on our board of directors. There's a few little perks, but essentially it's not much different if you participate in an activity as a member versus participate as just, you're not a member. But members do, and maybe if you donate irregularly, that is, greatly appreciated. But the membership support, because you've made a pledge saying, I'm going to give this much a month, or I'm going to give this much quarterly, or I'm going to give this much twice a year, or I'm going to give this much annually, then when we're making a budget for the year, we can plan a lot better for the year. So, but you can change your level of support or stop it at any time. And then there's the step of becoming a Buddhist and receiving the precepts, which we were just talking about. We do that once a year. We have precept study every year, and that's obviously open to anyone. And if you, and we do require that you be a member if you're going to receive the precepts. And if this is totally optional, you know, different people have different attitudes toward formally becoming a Buddhist. I just love the idea. As soon as I knew that it was possible, I'm like, yeah, sign me up. Like, it felt deeply significant to me, meaningful. When I had my Wagesa, I'm like, you know, I felt official. I really loved it. You know, other people are a little more wary. A lot of times this has to do with negative experiences with religious organizations in the past and just kind of being like, well, you know, some people are just like, I'm not a joiner. So, you know, especially with that level of public joining, some people have resistance to it, or other people really want it to be like, they want to be really clear about what that means and to be really straight with themselves before they make that vow. And I respect that. You know, it may be you need to be with the Sangha for a few years and study the precepts numerous times before you feel ready to say, yeah, I'm ready to formally make this vow. You know, I tend to be a little more, I'm pretty clear about what I want from the beginning. And I figure you make the vow and then sometimes maybe you break the vow, but you've got the vow to guide your life. So I tend to just jump into vows perhaps too quickly. Yeah. So then at the ceremony of Jukha, you promise to make the precepts part of your life. You receive a Wagesa. And yeah, it's another, in terms of the Sangha, it's another level of, well, when we look at it, the number of people who have received the precepts within our Sangha is another measure of just how engaged people are. But we also do not, other than like voting for board members, we don't differentiate between those who've received Jukai and actually, as a member, you can vote. If there was ever an issue with the voting, those who've received Jukai, like their weights are voted a little more, but it's never been a problem. So membership is you get the vote. So there's really nothing about having received Jukai that like now you're special or now you're in another class of people or anything. And so we definitely don't expect it or judge anyone as lesser if they don't do it. We're just happy if that's what you want to do. So all are welcome. And we try not to differentiate in any way, compare practice better or worse for people, whether you have just arrived, whether you're a member, whether you've received Jukai, whether you've taken more vows than that. To some extent, it doesn't really matter. But I will just say something about the power of vow and commitment that, and I think most of you, probably all of you, will appreciate that many of the deeper things in your life are associated with vow. Whether that is a vow that maybe you didn't formally take, but by having children, you know, you now are, you know, vowed to them. You are vowed to look after them and to support them and no matter what happens. Or it's, you know, vows of partnership. Maybe it is a commitment to a career, or it's a commitment to a cause or whatever. Vow may sound overly serious, perhaps, if you're like talking about Zen Center membership or something, but so you could just, vow is the most serious term for it, intention, but there's something about a explicit commitment, especially if you state it publicly, if you state it in front of other people, that it's going to give shape to your life. And inevitably, that there is going to be tension involved there. That is like the nature of commitment, right? If we just lived like each day, whatever, I'm gonna go here, I'm gonna go there, I'm gonna do what I feel like, I don't know, I don't give a damn. There's some merit to that and doing that sometimes, but then you're never going to come up against what in practice we are eagerly searching for, which is our edge, which is our resistance, which is our fears, which is et cetera. So that's what they're, you know, as soon as you commit to something, inevitably at some point, there's going to be like, damn it. Like, or I don't really like this, or I'm dissatisfied, or I want to be somewhere else. But sticking with that, like, I fortunately have always felt very, very committed to my practice. But that didn't mean that I always liked my practice or felt like doing my practice, you know, especially in my early, you know, years of junior monkhood. And it just was like, tired of it all, and I felt just gloomy and miserable, and I was, in many ways, I was just going through the motions, but the commitment to it carried me through that time, because it was just something I was going to do, and then things shifted and changed, and I never would have made it to that place of a different relationship or a deeper relationship or a freedom within it if I hadn't just stuck with the commitment. So anyway, that's just my little brief argument for vow and commitment. So I will just open it up for comments and questions about any of that.
So, I really appreciate that question and I appreciate your answer. I am one of those people that fall into probably two categories, prior past experience with religious stuff and not really a joiner. So that's kind of in me. And, but as I've been around, what I have found for me is that the precepts are aligned with my values. And in my life, when I've had struggles, anger, fear, worry, whatever, you know, it's my values that pull me through. And I feel like the precepts, again, they align with that. And what I also appreciate about my experience here is that, well, in other religions, it's sort of like there's sometimes a hierarchy and you're special, you know, and if you're special, these things happen. That really pulls on that ego, that thing that I have. I don't know if anybody else does, but I'm special. And I got sucked into this weird world of, and it wasn't right. And it wasn't values-based living. It was manipulative and it was for money and it was just not good stuff. And what I appreciate about my experience here is that there is no specialness involved in taking the vows or the precepts. There's no specialness. And from that, I was able to move from this place of wariness to being able to say, you know, I do want, this is what I want to live this value-based life. And I need help with that. And I like having the support of a teacher, a sangha, and not being like out on my own adrift. So thank whoever for the question and thank you for your answer.
Thank you. And I want to just remind everyone who is here or anyone who listens to this later that maintaining the culture, the healthy culture is a responsibility of all of us. You know, I may have an intention for none of these vows to mean that we are special or to differentiate between people or whatever, but you know, it might be easy for like, you just took the precepts and you might be like, ooh, Judith, are you going to take the precepts? Yeah, I mean, it'd be easy to just through minor unintentional ways to make it, to somehow start making it special or whatever. So yeah, just, I count on all of you to just remember, like, we want all of these things to be like, we want it to be entirely voluntary, right? We don't want to be mixing in all those other weird motivations. Although we may, I think that sometimes where people will maybe postpone taking the vows because they kind of suspect themselves of like wanting to be special or feeling like they don't belong unless they do this or whatever. So they're like, I don't know if I should do it yet. So then you might wait until you know that you're really doing it for the right reason. Rand.
Yeah, thank you. I guess you're just about as close to this topic as you're likely to be in any of your discussions. I think I've got a slightly different scenario situation with the whole Jukai thing. I've somewhat mentioned it to you before, but my Soketsu is from another Soto Zen. I don't know what you call it, organization or whatever, Silent Thunder in Atlanta 10 years ago. And I've pondered what it would mean if I were to do a Jukai ceremony again to get the Bright Way Zen Soketsu. And I've wondered what that might mean to me. And I just put it in the whole thing. And one, it almost feels like, well, it seems to a little bit devalue the vow that I took in the declaration of being a Buddhist before. And so then this would maybe be primarily about a belonging and with Bright Way Zen. And some of the thoughts I have about that are just, you know, like I've got this much larger vow to me, it's a really big vow to stay with Bright Way Zen until I pass away. Until I'm on the wrong side of the grass. And there's part of me that's like, well, I really, really would like to have the Bright Way Zen. Soketsu, what is it? What's the name of it?
We call it a Wagesa, which just means a hippie.
Yeah, okay. Well, would really like to have that before I went. And you know, then it's like about life and death. And it's like, well, maybe a week before I went so I could actually know I so, you know, I have some conflicted thoughts. Well, one thing I pretty much do to like, I don't think it would be now. And it's just like, I would have to show some period of time that shows a little bit more, you know, like almost competing with the time I've placed in other organizations and so forth. I want it to be just so thoroughly beyond reproach. But I have a lot of conflicting sensibilities about it because I have one and this like get another. And what are your thoughts about what that would actually mean? You know, transferring your, is it just a transfer of allegiance from one organization to another, or is it, you're still a Buddhist?
I got several interesting things to share in this regard.
Okay.
One is, if you would mute yourself, Rand, there's a little background noise. If you want to jump in and say anything, do. For one thing, my own husband received Jukai at Dharma Rain many, many, many years ago. And it took him quite a while to decide to do that because he felt like it was a little bit of a betrayal of his confirmation as a Lutheran many, many years before that. And he doesn't even believe in God or practice as a Lutheran anymore. But somehow for him, you know, so there's different ways I think people hold these vows and promises, and, you know, it's very variable. But kind of on the other extreme, the Wagesas or the you know, the Silent Thunder has a different term for it. That strip of cloth with a decorative knot at the bottom. Japanese people, Japanese practitioners, at least in Soto Zen, and I think it may go beyond that. I mean, they receive those for, like, if you go to Sojiji and participate in their Jukai retreat, you get another one. Like, I mean, you might collect them and you might participate in you might receive the precepts all kinds of times. So that's kind of the other extreme, right? Of just like, hey, you know, there's no harm in taking these precepts. Take them multiple times. So interestingly, we do have somebody who will be going through the precept ceremony in June, who I'm not sure if it's happened yet or is going to be happening in May, but he is going to go to Shasta Abbey, which is, you know, in our lineage, although ways back and a little different. He really wanted to receive the precepts in person. So he's going to go to their Jukai retreat. He's going to receive their precepts and receive a Wagesa. But he also wanted to do the ceremony with us. And so what he's going to do is, like, kind of renew his vows at our precept ceremony. And I will say that acknowledgement, like, in the ceremony, I would say, is it your wish to become a Buddhist? It is. And then we put the Wagesa over your head. And for him, I will say, is it your wish to deepen your vows as a Buddhist, or, you know, something like that. And then we'll put the Wagesa on. And then similarly, we had a woman in the past who had taken the refuges in Vajrayana and felt this similar kind of, like, she's not replacing that vow. And then I had that, you know, is it your wish to deepen your vow as a Buddhist? And she received the Wagesa. So yeah, there's many options. Brian.
Nothing better than when the deeper concepts of Buddhism just jump up at you in everyday life. So on Thursday, I had to have a medical procedure done that involved general anesthesia. So you're sitting there going through, answering a bunch of questions, and all of a sudden, the person at the computer goes, do you have a religious affiliation? And it literally just stopped me in my tracks. And I was about to say, well, it's complicated. And then I realized that's really not going to do anything for this interaction that we're having here. So I just mumbled. The only thing I could imagine is if it all had gone wrong, some poor guy getting a phone call saying, come over and give this guy some last rites or do something. So anyway, so I went with, you know, none of the above. Anyway, and the thing I was realizing is, well, boy, if there's self-nature, this is, you know, this is it. So I was, as you were talking earlier, I was kind of contrasting, like, the notion of vow in continuing to deepen or walk down the path of practice, or, you know, as a verb, you know, that makes sense in kind of sidestepping the identity question. Like, well, gosh, what am I? A lapsed, re-engaged Catholic whose faith has been deepened profoundly by 5 years of reading Buddhism? And does it, you know, it's so, anyway, so I think that is a good branch in a road, like, for me, you know, not spending too much time wrestling with the questions of identity and implications, and spending more time on the, you know, how is this additive to my practice, you know, kind of writ large. Anyway, it was a
wonderful point. I cannot quote directly. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but there, I believe, are numerous places where Dogen, you know, our Soto Zen ancestor in Japan, 13th century, basically says we should not call ourselves Buddhist. We should not call ourselves Zen. We should, like telling us not to differentiate or label ourselves like that at all, which of course we do. But, you know, taking that point of, like, this, that's not about It's not about identity. What does that really mean? That's not a fixed thing anyway. You know, really the most, I don't know, probably somebody, if we were to be really honest, right? And somebody said, all right, so what is your, you know, what is your spiritual path or whatever? Be like, well, I believe liberation can be found through facing the truth. You know, I mean, that's in a sense, like that's what I try to live by. More important than like what a Buddhist. James.
So I have a similar, wrestling as Rand is expressing, where I did actually take the precepts prior to coming to Brightway, but in a completely different tradition, in the Theravada Thai forest tradition, which is only the five precepts and not, you know, the full 16, the Bodhisattva precepts. So when I came to Bright Way, I had that thought like, oh, is it not cool of me to take the precepts here because I've already done it there and that kind of thing. And I realized, and it's probably something I realized through, you know, deciding to do the precepts class and hearing the talks and reading the book and whatnot. But I realized, oh, wait a minute, you know, taking the precepts is, it's okay to do it again, because you're just, to your point, you're just renewing that commitment. Like I'm going to say this, and I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to do it again. Mm-hmm. It's not a one-time shot, you know, it's just, I keep coming back to it and coming back to it and coming back to it. And the thing that really motivated me to take the precepts to begin with in the early other tradition, but then also here, is just the way in which, and this alludes to something, I can't remember if Jeannie said it or not, but about how in other religious practices, the commandments or the rules, right, are more about you, you know, more about, well, your stature. And, you know, on a really basic kind of scriptural level in Christianity, at least, it's, you know, have you repented your sins and become saved in the blood of Jesus Christ and all that? Because that's the only way you're going to get into heaven. And it seems to have very little emphasis on how are you then going out and engaging with the world and with others. And what I love about the precepts is it's not about me at all directly and about my stature. It's about others. You know, and like Norman Fisher says, it really great. He's like, Zazen is perfect precept practice, because you're just sitting there and you can't be hurting anyone. You can't be stealing. You can't be lying. You can't be abusing intoxicants. Like, you are practicing the precepts when you're sitting Zazen. And that idea that the precepts are really about everybody else and not me, you know, and how am I engaging the world on a compassionate level? And that's, I've carried that with me. And that's like the big shining light exclamation point that makes the precepts so powerful to me, is it's not like this edict, like you're not going to get what you want out of life unless you do this. It's like, what do others need in their lives, and how can you help them get that? So thank you.
And I do think it's relevant too that when we receive the precepts, what are we promising to do? We're promising to try to live by these moral guidelines and make them the mirror for our actions. But we're not promising to be a Soto Zen Buddhist forever. We're not promising to stay at Bright Way and never leave. We're not promising anything. We're not even promising to meditate. So in a way, like, you could, even if those other things change in your life, you could still, you know, hold those precepts. I suspect you will still believe that that's a good way to live, no matter what. Yeah.
I think I get stuck on feeling like a poser. I'm not worthy. It's not, I don't know. That, I think that's it. I don't even know if I have a question, but I feel like if I take that next step, and go through Jukai, I won't be able to honor it because I'm just posing. And yeah, I'm, oh.
I mean, and that really brings up the question of, you know, what does it really mean? And I think until people clarify that for themselves, like, what does this require of me? I mean, if you really took it literally, like, do not indulge anger, like, uh-oh. I mean, I'm definitely a poser then too, you know. So what does it mean? I mean, I guess there is a support and a refuge to be found in these vows. No matter our weaknesses, no matter our kind of confusion about our motives or anything like that. Dogen talked, he didn't make up the story, but there's a Zen story about, because in terms of multiple lifetimes, there was a woman who was a prostitute. And she was just, as a joke, I don't know, somehow they got these nun's robes, and she put on the nun's robes and she's dancing around and everybody's laughing and, you know, like, you know, total like disrespect and everything. But then in a subsequent life, she was born and became a nun. And it's like this kind of this power of vow and intention, even when we stray from intention, if you have said, this is what I want to do, or there's some kind of affinity or some kind of longing for it, then, and we honor that, you know, it's also, what is it like? We have two wolves inside us, like, you know, like it's not black and white, but I don't know, like you, it's whatever you feed, right? So some senses, taking these vows is feeding that part of us that aspires to live better and to be more compassionate and understand. And then we just kind of discover what they really mean on the way. And people will sometimes ask, like, I don't know that I can commit to not eating meat. You know, I live with people who eat meat. And we're like, well, you know, you decide for yourself exactly how you can live that do not kill precept. You know, maybe you have people have talked about recently in the precept class about lying, you know, somebody saying they actually work in kind of a social service setting where sometimes they have to stretch the truth to benefit their clients, or their clients might lose their support. And, you know, so then they have to sometimes fudge on that one, hopefully for compassionate reasons. And, you know, and then there's a like, you know, is it still okay to have a glass of wine at night? And I say yes. I mean, it's up to us, right? But especially those later ones of like, do not dwell on past mistakes, do not, you know, praise self and blame others. And I mean, these are like, you know, you've done it in your mind long before it comes out of your mouth or it manifests in your behavior. So I guess, yeah, we're imperfect from the very beginning. But that's so, you know, sometimes I imagine some of you, if you have come out as a Buddhist to your friends or family, you know, that sometimes as you're getting upset in traffic or something like that, they'll be like, oh, I thought you were a Buddhist. You know, and it's like, but you won't find other Buddhists saying that, right? Because they'll know, well, they know you aspire not to do that. And right at the moment you're doing that. And that's because none of us are perfect. So Judith.
Well, I too, it was Jenny that sat here two seats ago.
Jeannie,
sorry. Hearing. So I agree with her totally. I mean, that is how I feel about things. And I have no big, strong religious background other than San Francisco Zen Center, which was filled with problems and plenty to think about. But I take refuge and have taken refuge in the jaundiced eye and acerbic wit, or what I fancy to be acerbic wit. And I have a feeling that I would have to lose that. And that's sort of my protective covering.
That is a fascinating, koan. You know, I think as we practice, and if we find out, so one way, there's many ways to phrase practice, but one way is renunciation, that we renounce that which causes suffering. So if we recognize, you know, some behavior, some thought, some whatever causes suffering for ourselves or others, then we go about renouncing it. I mean, not that it's an instant thing, right? I won't do that anymore, but just we raise that spirit of renunciation. I don't want to do that anymore. That's our karma verse, you know, all my past and harmful karma, I now fully avow, take responsibility for it. But there are those, like, who are we going to become if we really, you know, go deeply down the path of practice? If, what are we going to have to renounce? You know, are things that we actually really identify with or love or enjoy, are we going to have to renounce them? And I guess we really don't know, right? We don't know until we're willing to try and look. But I guess I can say, in terms of encouragement, because I don't know, different people probably have different ideas about this, but I kind of imagined that if I really, really, really practiced, I would just become like a, I know, kind of like a zomboidal automaton, right? I don't really care. I'm not really affected. I'm not upset. I don't have any great desires or passions. I'm just cool. I didn't really want to become like that, right? But I didn't become like that. So it's like you release your grasping on certain ways that you are, certain things that you do, and just really ask, what is my relationship to this? Is there some suffering, some grasping version, delusion underneath there? And maybe we have to release it. But then it's like, what comes back? So there's like the three pure precepts, right? Cease from evil, release all self-attachment, do good for others. So the first is stopping, right? Like, what happens if I don't do this? What happens? And we don't even really know what to replace it with. I, for instance, kind of similarly, I don't know. And then my way of connecting people was to be sarcastic and often self-deprecating. And I don't know, people found it funny. And that was how I conversed with people. And that was how, frankly, I think I avoided being invisible, which is something that I had experienced as a kid in social situations, that I'm just nothing. So at least I was being noticed. I don't know. So anyway, this was a pattern. And as I kind of, especially the self-deprecating stuff, as I kind of found the inspiration to try to not do that, I was like, I don't really know what I'm gonna say. What am I don't know. Like, I was a little worried, like, I would just become socially, like, really awkward, and I don't know. But then something new arose, you know, after that cessation, and then, like, what is doing good? And then I noticed, as I was sitting there talking with people, that if I listen, they'll talk. They'll talk a lot, especially if I ask some good questions. So I realized in some ways, I'm like, wow, I think every conversation I've had has been all about me. That's it. I'm just like, oh my God, that explains a lot. Look back, right? And then, all right, so actually being kind of interested in the person that I'm talking to and asking some questions, and then noticing some kind of humor that could come back, which didn't feel too negative or self-deprecating, some kind of humor that could come back and, you know, in this kind of setting, let people know that I'm not a, you know, stuffy superior priest, or Zen isn't, you know, about being really tight-assed or anything. So I don't know, then stuff tends to come back and we don't end up boring automatons. Jinryu.
You know, when I took the precepts, I just wanted to belong. And I wanted to get through that so that I could belong more fully. If you take the precepts formally, I can guarantee you, I can promise you this without a doubt, nothing bad will happen. So I was looking through, as you were last talking, Demio, I was looking through the Kyoju Kaimon again, and I know this is in there, but I couldn't find it quickly. But Bodhidharma often talks about the realm of the Buddhas or the realm of the Dharma. It's subtle and mysterious. So the kinds of things we're talking about, if there is going to be a change in me, it will be so subtle and so mysterious that I won't even know it's happening. Really, 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, I'm going through Jukai again because other people are doing it. I look back at myself and I think, wow, I don't do that anymore. It's all good. There is nothing bad about this experience.
Tyler.
Yeah, so I waited a couple years before I took Jukai. There was one kind of shortly after I first joined, but that was, you know, just a few months until I witnessed that. And then I went a whole year with Bright Ways Zen, and I was going to take it. And I was like, no, I'm just, there was something holding me back. I've never been a joiner, as it were, in this sort of sense. So we had another year and I kind of worked through it. And it seemed right. And I'm really glad I waited and it worked for me, but I will say I'm shocked at how meaningful it was to take that and receive the Wagesa, in the sense that taking that vow publicly and then having this reminder, you know, I wear it anytime I'm taking part in Rosanna, talking about it, because it's every time you put it on, it's just that one thing that actually reminds you of the, because it's very easy day to day to realize you're maybe not living by the vow and having to reflect on that. But this is sort of a daily reminder every time I meditate to put it on, that I took that vow and I feel it on there. And it's again, like, I can't explain to you the shock of the meaningfulness of it. Because that wasn't kind of who I imagined, or it wasn't something I'd ever experienced or had been brought up to sort of appreciate. So if you're, you know, I say take your time and do it when it's right, but also that it can be a really meaningful experience. And it doesn't mean you give up anything of who you are necessarily, but it just adds so much to your practice. That's just with my experience.
Thank you, Tyler. You remind me too of if you are here for morning meditation on the Sundays, after the first period of meditation, well, no, actually, because we do chanting first, but we do a little period of meditation and then we end with the robe verse. So all, you know, we say the first one in Japanese and second all, you know, how great the robe of liberation. And we put our wagesas or our rakusus on our head. I don't really know why. It's just a sign of like respect. And we say the first and then we put them on. And the idea being that we put them on fresh each day. That we sit, I mean, if you're sitting at home and you're only going to sit for 30 minutes, you know, you can say the little robe first and put the wagesa on and sit, right? But kind of in a, if we're in a retreat or something like that, we sit for a whole period of meditation first. It's like to reconsider our vow so that we take it fresh all the time. This question ended up being just perfectly timed for our upcoming Chukai ceremony.
Very quickly, I just want to put a word in for the jaundiced eye, because that's how you see the next apocalypse coming, or that's how you are aware of the repeat of history of what happened in Germany.
I wouldn't describe that with the same term, but I mean, we might call it discriminating mind. You know, being able to see right from wrong, being able to see justice from injustice. I similarly was really resistant to certain aspects of practice because I didn't want to lose that. I mean, I would rather suffer for the rest of my life than give that up. That is not, I'm no. So I was kind of afraid to my mind, to take the medicine of emptiness, right? To see things as empty. And because I'm like, if that means I'm just going to be like, well, you know, look at all those starving people. Well, you know, suffering comes and goes. And no. So, I am incredibly relieved and thrilled to have found out that taking the medicine of emptiness does not dull the discriminating mind. You know, it changes our relationship to it. For me, it gives me a ground to stand on, which technically is not, it's nowhere. Like in the sutras, it says the bodhisattva stands nowhere, but they stand. They're firmly standing, but it's, there's not based on anything. It's firmly standing, but to see, so it gives me that ground, which tells me at a deep, deep, deep level, everything is precious just as it is. And that's not in opposition to the terrible things. And that is a deep source of strength and peace of mind and sanity and all of that. And then, and certainly that could be a spiritual dead end, is to then just stay there, right? Just stay in your spiritual bliss off on a mountaintop somewhere and just be of no good to anybody, which is why we have the bodhisattva vow, right? So then we turn and look at the world. But for me, it feels like and it's not easy at all. But when I look out and I see the destruction and the injustice, which still can just like move me to tears at a moment's notice, I can get the self out of that scenario. So I feel like it helps me see more clearly. The self is I don't have an existential need for everything to work out. And yet that like, yeah. So all I could say is like, you don't lose your discriminating mind unless you choose to go hide out. Well, here we are, 12:15. Mm-hmm. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. Mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. So that was one of the questions. One out of three of the questions. So this is great.